Blog Talk Radio.
Join Irma Francis as she explores the transformation from adulthood to soulhood. Having achieved the life goals of adulthood and met the expectations of family and society, we may feel like there is something missing. This something could be a direct contact with our soul. It is through soul contact that we become ready to let go of the conditioned self and allow our true self to step forward and take the lead. We shift into a deep and compassionate soulhood, connecting us to our divinity as well as our humanity. Irma Francis opens a portal to the exploration of soulhood by inviting open-ended inquiries into this eternal dimension.
Hello and welcome to Adulthood to Soulhood. This is Irma Francis and I'm joined by Ernie Vecchio, psychologist, author, speaker, and spiritual teacher. Hello, Ernie.
Hey, Irma. Always great to be here doing something for humanity.
Great to have you here.
That's not a word you hear every day in your introduction. Humanity. Doing something for humanity.
Well, I'm excited that we're going to begin going through your book, The Soul's Intent, An Interview with the Divine. And we're going to do this chapter by chapter on our radio show here. And I think this is a wonderful chapter tonight. And we were talking a little bit before the show began about the current news and how your teachings kind of relate to what's going on. I don't know if you want to share a little bit about what we were talking about.
Yeah, I think we were talking about the shootings in Orlando. The one that really is a heartbreaker is the singer that was on The Voice. At least what I saw in the news about that is that when the man approached her, she opened her arms to give him a hug and he shot her. Well, I think what we were talking about is that the press and the media tends to want to know why these things happen or how somebody can have such a psychotic break. And what I was saying before we went on the air is that this is personality disorder in the extreme, that these are personality disorders that are really going unnoticed or unchecked by anybody and is a result of not having any kind of internal life. Or any kind of connection to their own compass, to use your word, their own humanity, that detachment when experienced in a psychotic break is that they're capable of doing all kind of atrocious things. And so we tend to see the extreme cases in the media, but we have lots of people walking around with a lot of guilt and shame and a lot of alienation and indifference and apathy. And so, yeah, this work that I do, you know, we were talking about, we're going through the book, The Soul's Intent. We're really moving or shifting our discussions and the videos that we make into the brand of The Soul's Intent, which is really the umbrella that captures all the things that I teach. And so, and the reason why The Soul's Intent captures that so well is because the intelligence of the soul, the wisdom of the soul, is where this information is coming from, and not just from my own personal work, but from the works from the work of thousands of other people that I've helped recover from trauma. So The Soul's Intent's a good umbrella for that, and so I'm excited about us keeping that as kind of like the context for everything that we talk about.
And that's great that you mentioned that. I wanted to make sure that we mentioned that on the show tonight. So I'm just really excited about going through this book with you and getting to share it with our listeners, you know, through the radio show and more on the videos on your YouTube channel. And tonight, the chapter that chapter one, the wound, developing insight from your life experiences. So you do have an example in here on the first page of chapter one, where you talk about the exercise that you did with in a workshop with your with the participants, where you asked them about the to imagine the instrument of which they were cut away. Maybe you can expand on what the wound is according to chapter one.
Well, it certainly makes sense that if I'm going to be talking about the source wound, that I at some level talk about my own. And I've said before in many shows that we've done that personality disorder is formed by two very unique emotions. One is guilt and the other is shame. And being able to know the difference between guilt and shame kind of defines what kind of disorder that we have. And guilty people tend to suffer with self-blame and self-punishment and feel like that they can't do anything right. They're just constantly making mistakes. And shame is more self-hatred, self-loathing, and the sensation that one is a mistake. And so of those two, shame was my demon. And for anybody who's been following me along the way, my background was kind of I guess the word would be dysfunctional beginning, with alcoholic parents, early divorce, child of the state, raised in an orphanage, et cetera, et cetera. So as I was going through all of that, I had to work through and understand and heal the shame. And so what happened in the workshop that I mentioned about in that first chapter is that somebody asked me how I did it. You know, how did you get to where you are now with all of this? And so I had everybody in the room close their eyes and imagine an instrument that's used in the cutting of an umbilical cord. And it was a room of 150 people, I think, and predominantly women. And so they raised their, and I said, raise your hand when you have a response. And so the first two responses I got would be the normal responses, which is a scalpel and scissors. Mm-hmm. And so when they had exhausted those two responses, the room kind of went silent. I said, okay, what I want you to do now is change the instrument that cuts the umbilical cord to a hacksaw or a chainsaw or a hatchet or even a toothbrush. What happens to the image? Well, most of the women in the room were squirming in their seats and saying, well, it'd be gorier. It would be more painful. And so I said, okay, what I want you to do is open your eyes. And what I said was, is that when I figured out that we all get cut away from the Creator, we all get cut away from the Mother, the only thing that sets us apart as human beings is the instrument used in the cutting. And so so that when I came to that realization, I began to see that my journey, my trauma with shame, is the same as everybody's journey. The only thing that sets it apart really is the story itself, is the context of the story. And so that's really what I consider the source wound to be, is if we get cut away from the Creator in the beginning, in this case the Mother, and then we take on language around 18 to 24 months, we take on language, and as soon as we begin to identify with our names, the ego begins to form. That is really the what I call the fated break, so to speak, that we are connected to the source, connected to the Creator, connected to our own soul's intent, to our heart's intent, until ego takes over, and then we kick into this adaptive mode, and then whatever we experience in the adaptation really is what forms personality. So if you grow up like I did in a beginning that's maladaptive, then you have to make adjustments, you see. And in my case, if you're dealing with worth issues and self-esteem issues, and you're having to find a context for whether or not you're worthy and whether or not you can accumulate any sense of self-esteem. And so it's a healing of that particular wound. It is the journey for shame. So yeah, if that makes any sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you go on and how the book is written. I just love how it's written. I just want to read just a little bit from the next page. As the ego seeks spiritual balance in its separation from the source, the soul can provide answers. So what you've done in this book is you've presented each chapter as a conversation between the seeker, the ego, and the divine, our own divinity, the soul. The ego can become self-aware only if it communicates with its above observer, the soul. The soul's guidance is connected to the divine, which encompasses all that can be intuitively perceived and offers the ego a larger context of existence. Without the soul, the ego is trapped in the past. The sequence of the conversation reflects a logical path of spiritual revelation and rebirth. The soul's intent demonstrates that a wonderful higher organizing intelligence is at work in our lives. And so that's the whole book is set up chapter by chapter between the seeker, which is the ego, and the divine, which is our own divinity, our soul. So I thought what we could do is just go through and I will ask the question of the seeker, and you can kind of, if you recall what's in your book or just what comes to mind tonight.
I may end up giving a different answer that's in the book, but it'll be in the ballpark. It'll be somewhere in the ballpark.
Because you wrote this book, how long ago, Ernie? What was the year?
I want to say 2002, but I'm not positive about it. Think about it.
Yeah, I should have looked. I'm sure it says somewhere in the book here. It has the date.
It's
been a while.
It was 2008. I have to kind of remember. It was 2008.
Yeah. So I'll ask the question, and then whatever comes to your mind, and then I did kind of just highlight certain parts in things that stood out to me. So the first question is, this is the seeker, so the ego. Why do we feel emptiness in or around our stomach? Is this the first source wound?
Yeah, and that's a great question because what I want the folks to understand is that these questions that are being asked by the seeker are actually real questions that my patients were asking me. And they were saying it, and what they were doing really is they were describing the sensation, I feel an emptiness, I feel hollow, and when I said, well, where in your body were you feeling that? Invariably, it was always in the stomach. Well, so it makes perfect sense that since the umbilical cord is attached there, that the very first thing that we begin to experience when we get cut away from the Creator is we feel the loss of the synchronization of the heart of the mother, and we begin to feel the separation between I and me and us and we. So there's a distinction between myself, my own identity, as it relates to the world around me. And so when we feel that sensation of being apart from the Creator and also being in the culture, if you will, as different, then we really have our first experience of grief. So that question is really about it's really asking, why do we feel grief in the stomach? Because that's where grief would be experienced in the body. It would be in the stomach, because that's where, when you think of putting food in the stomach and being full of nourishment, or being empty, or the lack of nourishment, that's where we feel it. It's physically in the body, in the stomach. So it's kind of a common sense, logical kind of answer to that question. But that is the first source wound. And so our first source wound then is the fated break, the cutting away from the Creator, or loss of self. And in spiritual genre or spiritual terminology, loss of self, which means loss of the authentic self. And so what we end up doing when we take on ego is we put away who we we're intended to be and become whatever it is we need to become to survive our life and circumstances. Mm. And so dependent upon how traumatic that those experiences are, or even not traumatic. I mean, it doesn't have to be a stake through the heart. It doesn't have to be a dysfunctional beginning like my own. It could simply be that you grow up around a family that enough is never enough, or you grow up around a family that says that if I didn't have you, I'd be happier because you're a burden. or if you grow up in a family where somebody says, well, you know, we didn't plan you. You were a mistake. It's a message that you literally get from the environment that you internalize, and it becomes a source of your own identity. And so whatever really kind of fuels that guilt and shame paradigm is really what sets up the magnification of that original source wound. So I look at it kind of like, if you can imagine the source wound being like Velcro, where everything sticks to it, or it would be like a snowball that, and when you roll it out across the yard, it gets bigger as the further you roll it. That's what the source wound is kind of symbolic of. It becomes the sticky part that all of your adversity and all your pain kind of accumulates. And mm-hmm. and if you never resolve any of it, never fix any of it or heal any of it, then you can see that it's a lifetime of accumulation. And so that accumulation really doesn't start to becoming into our awareness until around midlife, unless mm-hmm. we undergo severe trauma or severe dysfunction, then it may happen sooner. Mm-hmm. But we are aware of the grief, and we certainly are aware of the accumulation of the suffering. Yeah.
Yeah, and that does would create a feeling of something being off, because something is off. And if you're not living your life from your authentic self, from your true self, then something is off. And whether we can identify that or not, that is what it is. And something I was just thinking as you were talking is that the only way a parent could see the authentic self, the true self in their child, is if they have an awareness of it in themselves.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And it's not a coincidence that the capacity in which one parents themselves trickles down to the children. So if you're not a very good parent to yourself, if you're hypocritical, if you don't practice what you preach, if you don't display some level of integrity in your day-to-day life that the child can imitate, mirror, or see in some way, because children are very perceptive. They see the contradictions, they see the hypocrisy, and they're trying to make sense of themselves in relationship to you and mm-hmm. how you treat them. So it's very true that, which is why that pathology or psychopathology tends to run in families. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times, mm-hmm. you'll hear people say, well, my mother was anxious, my father was anxious, or my mother was depressed, or my father was depressed, or they were bipolar, or they were schizoaffective, all these labels that we give it. But I think the point is that they say, I've got it because I inherited it. Well, it doesn't mm-hmm. have to be severe psychological disorder. It just can be simply a distortion of self, that you inherit yeah. some distorted idea of yourself. It's kind of like I said to you one time before on the air, if you ask somebody on a self-esteem scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being as great as you feel about yourself, where would you put yourself? And the person says, well, I think right now, today, I would say I'm a 4. And then I would say, well, okay, is that a good day or a bad day? And they say, well, that's probably a good day. Well, how low do you go on that scale on a bad day? Well, all the way to 1. So 4 plus 1 is 5. And 5 divided by 2 is 2.5. So then you're saying on that scale from 1 to 10, you're a 2.5. And they would go, well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I guess I am. Well, that 2.5 is your inheritance. Whatever you attach to that, you know, and I've even said to people, at least you got a 2.5. I got a 0. You know, I had no self-esteem from my parents. And so, but I think the point that I want to say there is it's made up. It's a made up number. It's a made up scale. Mm-hmm. But the distortions that we internalize really guide our lives until we decide to fix the distortions, whatever they may be.
Yeah, boy, that's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it, yeah.
And really all you have to do is ask the person, you know, what makes up the 2.5? Why do you think you're a 2.5? They will verbatim say to you probably what their parents said to them.
Yeah.
I'm too fat.
Yeah.
I'm not smart enough. I should have done more with my life than I did. They will quote almost verbatim what was said to them as they were evolving as people. And so, and again, that's where they're from, but that isn't who they are.
Right.
And that's what the book would say about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Something I thought of when we were talking about that the parent can't see the true self in the child if they aren't aware of their own true self. And I thought of the line from Avatar, I see you and that means I love you. And really, I mean, that's the greatest gift you can give your child is to say, I see you, and not you who I want you to become, but the you that is you were born with and nurture that and grow that. Yeah. Something you said
you,
in.
You,
Yeah.
I was going to say the you that you are.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a line in here in this first question. This book is just so rich. The soul pours itself into a container called personality. It starts as clay and later becomes hardened ceramic. The spiritual question, are you the container or its contents? The soul teaches that you must let go of personality before you can discover your true essence. I really like that. It's so, the image is so great, starting out as clay and becoming hardened ceramic. So,
and when you think about the human ego, you have to recognize that that's what it is. It's nothing but I'm calling the container, but what it really is, it is an accumulation of your beliefs and your feelings and emotions. Is an accumulation of that, almost like a computer program or almost like a hard drive that literally is just storing all this information away. If you never bother to look at any of that and make sense of any of that, then you're going to live it as if it's truth. And many of us do. And it's important to add here too, Irma, that really our parents only have influence on that in those early developmental years between birth and about six is what most experts would say is when personality is formed. And then from about 6 to 12 or 13, it turns into a hard fixed structure. But we're saying that personality isn't totally fully formed until 30. Mm. So, you know, that we have different opinions about that now. I think the point is that whatever the formation of ego is occurring, it isn't all just the parents. I mean, the parents are the beginning, but then our peers take over, the school system takes over, culture takes over. And so depending upon, you know, again, going back to that sticky source wound, depending upon how much is sticking to the surface of that wound when you enter a junior high school, for example, or when you enter high school, if you haven't sorted through some of those earlier kind of distortions about who you are, then you're going to carry those right into your young adult life, you see. And all you need to have is just a couple. If you are somebody who has grown up with a lot of guilt, which is mistake-driven, all you have to do is just make a couple bad choices and make a couple mistakes, and then you begin to reinforce the belief that you're nothing but this incompetent somebody who just continues to make mistakes, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So all you have to do is just have a couple, you know, just a couple external experiences to then make it feel like it's real, make it feel like it's true. So it kind of becomes not much unlike a program that we begin to live inside of, kind of a conditioned program of who we think we are, and until we discover who we really are. And so that doesn't happen developmentally until we begin to start asking questions about who we think we are and begin to kind of challenge that inside ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. One time in one of our off-the-air conversations, we were talking about how the soul orchestrates our dreams sometime by showing us our shadow and the importance of all of that. And somewhere within that conversation, you were talking about, you know, like when we get up in the morning, the first thing, you know, we kind of are in our soul as we're sleeping and our soul is communicating to us. And then we wake up and as soon as our feet hit the floor, well, the hard drive kicks on, which is the ego. And there
right.
we are in the the
in
land
the, in,
of the ego.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're in the program. Yeah. We got
yeah,
up and we're in the program.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a conscious choice to be able to tell the difference. You know, where does the program stop and start, and where do I stop and start? I mean, that's what you have to sort out. And so it's important. I said before we went on the air about the shootings in Florida, when the news broadcasters are really asking how did these kinds of things happen, it's the lack of an internal life, any kind of internal connection to your own humanity, any kind of internal connection to the heart, which is the real human compass, instead of the ego, which is the default compass. And I said that I wrote somewhere, I forgot where I wrote it, I think it might be in the Job book, but I said that that to have an inner life is like being able to see in the dark.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
literally... And that literally is what we would call the collective ego or the culture, because it is predominantly the dark that we are trying to sift through on a day-to-day basis, what to allow in, what to screen out, how to be in the world of the collective ego and what all that means. And so being able to see in the dark is only possible if one has some internal connection to their own heart and to their own soul, because in that you are grounded, that in that groundedness you can walk between the worlds of ego and spirit or ego and soul. And that's really what we're all trying to accomplish in a spiritual sense, is the capacity to walk between those worlds.
Yeah,
because
and
we
that's
have
so
to, because we kind of have to. We don't really have a choice. We have to deal with it, and we have to deal with it and cope with it in some way. Yeah.
Right, yeah. So the next question that the seeker asks is, so this source wound becomes an entry wound that other wounds can affect?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what I meant when I said that it's that Velcro, it's that sticky surface that all other adversities kind of stick to. So, yeah, that's the short answer to that. But many of us don't think, and I think you had, when you and I first started talking, I think you had trouble with this logic too. People don't want to think they're wounded,
mm-hmm.
or they don't think of their experiences as a wounded experience. And it's because the ego doesn't want to admit that it's in pain or that it's less than, or that it's inadequate in some way. But the source wound is nothing to be ashamed of, because we all get cut away from who we were intended to be and adapt and become who we're expected to become. And so that's the wound. It doesn't have to be, like I said, a stake through the heart. It doesn't have to be an extreme, you know, kind of dysfunctional beginning. It could just be an accumulation of small little bumblebees.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And those bumblebees all represent individual insecurities, individual inadequacies that by themselves one single bee is not that big of a deal, but a swarm of bees, you see, would be a big deal. And so I'm using that metaphor because we've talked about it before, but I think that it's a good example that a lot of people think that to be wounded means you had to have really undergone extreme severe dysfunction. When actuality, it could just be one bee at a time, one
mm-hmm.
sting at a time, until you
yeah.
get an accumulation of a bunch of stings. It doesn't have to be one big abrupt. And that's what I learned in working with trauma. It's kind of like, wow, when I first asked the question, do we have to have a tree fall on us to wake up to this intelligence? Do we have to have our legs amputated to connect to the soul's and the heart's intent? And then after I posed that question, it was kind of like, yeah, I guess we kind of do. Because otherwise, it's this. If it isn't an abrupt awakening, then it's going to be this insidious, accumulative awakening. You see what I mean? And so it doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make a difference when or how you wake up, as you deal with the accumulation of your life experiences. The key is that you do wake up. And so if you're fortunate enough to have a spinal cord and to have your legs and to not have severe disability, not undergone severe trauma, doesn't mean that you don't have wounds you're still dealing with, which may just be little tiny, with little tiny sound bites that are every bit as debilitating as a large trauma would be. You see, it just took longer for it to, it just took longer for it to come into your awareness. That's all that means.
Makes a lot of sense. And there's a line in your answer in the book to that question. It just stood out to me. Essentially, ego encases your true nature for self-protection. And that really is what happens.
Yeah, that's what defense mechanisms are. When you think about what personality is, it's an accumulation of traits and defense mechanisms. And if you want to, if you want an image for a defense mechanism, it's like you, it's like some technique or some strategy you use to cope with hurt feelings or some kind of hurtful experience, and you began to wear it every day. And so now let's give it a size. Let's say that you did this at the age of 5, and the defense that you put on was a white T-shirt at the age of 5. Well, that defense that you used at the age of 5 stays with you for the rest of your life. So imagine that every time somebody hits that particular soft spot or pushes that button in your personality, you try to put on a 5-year-old T-shirt. It doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
Your defense mechanisms, and so you have to regress. And so what you have to do so that the shirt will fit, you have to regress to the age of 5.
Oh, wow. What a good example.
No matter what chronological age you are, you will go back so that T-shirt fits.
Mm.
And it happens in a millisecond. You know, in a millisecond, you will, and it's called regression. You will regress to the memory of when the wound first happened, and you will also regress to the defense that you used to prevent the wound from happening again. And so there you are, emotionally behaving like a 5-year-old.
And that's literally
how it works. I mean, that's literally what happens. But it's happened so quick and so out of our awareness, we're not even aware that's what's happening. So when you think of the ego, it is an accumulation of defense mechanisms that you put on that really at the time you put them on probably fit the circumstances, but they don't fit the present. You see, which is why you need to let go of some of those defense mechanisms. And the only thing that will make you let go of a defense mechanism is an abrupt awakening of some kind, a trauma, a suffering of some sort, will then make you reevaluate and say, wait a minute, that defense mechanism's outdated. It doesn't fit.
Right.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And disorder would be trying to make it fit.
Wow.
When you try to make a defense mechanism fit where it doesn't, then that's disorder.
Huh. That's a really great image to have. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So now the seeker is asking, does this wound foster self-abuse?
Yeah. Well, that really is the my way of talking about self-esteem and self-worth, confidence, and all those self kind of acronyms that we use, that if the source wound begins to accumulate the wounds of our life experiences, then we begin to evaluate ourselves against this ruler or this standard of like that 1 to 10 scale. We compare ourselves to the standard of where the wound came from, and if we take it on as truth, well, maybe I am stupid. Maybe I can't do anything right. Maybe I am my own worst enemy. So why bother? So we begin to start, that ends up becoming self-abuse and self-sabotaging. As soon as we take on the distortion as truth, it sabotages our potential and our abilities. So we take on the esteem of the self-worth kind of issues and wear them as if they are truths. And in that regard, it becomes self-esteem. And then, and then, of course, what happens, and we already know this in terms of the research, we already know now that a lot of addiction begins, drug addiction begins in junior high school. And there's a reason why junior high school is a volatile time for that. It's because that's when hormones kick in for boys and girls around 11, 12, 13 years of age. And when those hormones kick in, emotions take on a different complexion. And so we have to learn how to cope with those emotions and how to interpret those emotions as we evaluate ourselves in relationship to the world around us. And so, again, if we have a distorted self-image based upon a beginning that was distorted, then we're kind of groping in the dark to try to get some sense of who we are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You also talk about...
I was just going to say, and we all go through this. I mean, this is, I mean, self-esteem, self-confidence, self-worth, these are supposed to be developmental stages of pre-adolescence and adolescence, power, adequacy. These are the kind of terms we use to describe those adolescent stages. And if you haven't got all that worked out by the time you hit your early 20s, then that's what you take into your life and what you take into the world. And how you perform and how effective you are in your life. I think it's called ego strength. That would be the word for it. If you haven't got really ego strength to be able to discern between what's true and what isn't, then you're kind of struggling with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And in the self-esteem and the self-worth and all the things you just mentioned, something we rarely get to and rarely talk about is self-love.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, if there's one special thing, there's many special things that are coming out of intentional guided evolution and coming out of this spiritual, what's the word I'm looking for? Wisdom that I'm attempting to share is that we really didn't and don't have a quality, a valid, integrous definition of self-love. And I've learned through my own personal work and through the works of these thousands of other people that self-love really is the capacity to suffer with oneself, which is the definition of compassion. So self-love is being able to be compassionate with oneself in the worst of times. And so, in other words, kind of sitting with your own suffering, sitting with your own adversities, until something else comes through other than what the ego says. Because we already know what the ego is going to say. The ego is going to say, turn it off, stop it, stop the pain, distract yourself, take a drug, find a new girlfriend, get a new job, whatever the ego is going to say. It's not going to sit with it. It doesn't want to sit with it. And so self-love is the capacity to sit with oneself until something else comes through that is more intuitive and less cognitive about how you are and who you are in relationship to the world. And so that's the definition of self-love that is coming out of this work with me, which is a valid definition of self-love. It isn't an egoic, exaggerated sense of self. It's it's self-love that is really born out of a certain amount of humility for a life that has been lived fully. And and that full life means the good, bad, and ugly of it. That life is glorious. Yeah. Life is glorious with its good, its bad, and its ugly. You see, and the soul has to have, and you have to have a kind of a connection to your own soul to get a sense of that. Mm-hmm. You know, if that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, and self-love then. As you share in your teachings, is having compassion with one's own suffering.
And that, yeah, versus four.
With,
yeah.
Versus
and,
four.
Yeah, and that was one of the. Yeah, and that was one of the distortions that came out early in my work is that when you ask most people to define the word compassion, they tend to define it as sacrifice and martyrdom, or loving, or caring for somebody. And the keywords are being 444. And so we've kind of got the definition skewed because we're comparing it to the Christ concept, which is, he died for us, which is really not what happened. Christ died with us, not for
mm-hmm.
us. And mm-hmm. so the fact that we say for us makes Christ a martyr. If you take that approach and you follow it to its conclusion, then you would have to also say that, well, if he suffered for us, then we shouldn't have to suffer at all. We shouldn't have to do martyrdom. We shouldn't have to do sacrifice. He's already done it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, what we're doing is we're trying to do, we're taking on that language and making up that is the definition of compassion, when actually it means to be able to put yourself in the shoes of another and to sit with them during their suffering. It isn't about carrying the burden. I don't remember where I read this. It might have been Robert Moore or Joseph Campbell or some way years ago, but I remember there was somebody who wrote a book, and there was a phase or a section of the book that the seeker was looking for Christ. And they were going through the village, and this is during the time that Christ was living, and they were going through the village trying to find Christ, and they were asking some of the wise men at the time, how will I know who he is? And they said, well, you will see him standing in the middle of the town square, wrapping and unwrapping his wounds as he is helping others. He is a wounded healer. He is a wounded healer. So that business of being a wounded healer is really the message of Christ, that he was a wounded healer. Well, and so too are we.
Mm.
If Christ was, so too are we, capable of being wounded healers. And that really is every helping profession on the planet.
So true.
A lot of noise. I don't know if you're hearing all that noise. I just heard a bunch of noise. I don't know what that was. Sound like a freight train going by. It was some kind of feedback. I don't know what. Yeah. So the idea is that we're all wounded healers, and the people that know that best are nurses and doctors and counselors and therapists. These are all wounded healers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not connected to your own woundedness, then you're just trying to be a healer without fixing your own wounds, and you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
there
we're
was
all,
something...
but I think as human,
yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think as human beings, we all have a little bit of that in us. We all have some wounded healer in us. If we care about mankind and humanity at all, we have some of that in us already. Yeah.
Right. I was just going to say something you said either in one of our personal conversations or on the air, and it really stuck with me because I was talking about the spiritual community and the seemingly importance of having no ego, to be egoless. And what you said was, well, it's not really to be egoless, it's to be victimless. And that really, really stood out to me, because that's the difference between compassion for and compassion with. I mean, it's a victim would be compassion for, and martyr and suffering for. Yeah, that really was a huge clarification.
Well, we're aware of this in the culture. We call burnout in the helping profession compassion fatigue.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
the reason that that particular terminology gets any kind of traction is because, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years and I've never felt compassion fatigue. I've never felt burnout. And I've never had that experience. But yet a lot of people in the helping profession do get burned out. And the reason why is they're trying to carry the suffering of the people they're working with. And you can't do that. You cannot carry the suffering. Yeah. Nurses probably are at the top of the list for that. The burnout in nurses is very high for that very reason. They tend to carry the suffering of their patients.
Mm. Well, I mean, there is a difference between empathy and compassion. And I mean, I know from in my own life experience being very empathetic, I think a person that has a lot of empathy, they do have a tendency to take on other people's feelings, and you can't do that. And I consider compassion actually a higher intelligence than empathy. Just mm-hmm. for that reason.
But it's these kinds of little distortions that I'm bringing kind of clarity to that because it all gets kind of lost in the interpretation. It all gets kind of lost in the language. We throw these words around: compassion, spirituality, self-love, enlightenment, consciousness. We throw all these words around, but we don't really have clear ways to define them that we can wrap our heads around in a way that enriches our own spiritual understanding of ourselves. And that's really the only value of these words, that they don't bring us to some sense of clarity about what the journey really is. Because it's all, if you want to simplify what the human condition is that we come into the world connected to something larger than ourselves, get disconnected from it, and then spend the rest of our lives trying to get back to it. Well, said differently, we're looking for a context to just simply be.
Right.
Because the context that we were given didn't quite work. The context mm-hmm. we were given, we came up short in some respects. And how do we know that? Because we didn't reach our potential. We can't maintain long-term relationships. We can't get along with our neighbors. We don't like people. We feel alienated, indifferent, apathetic, angry, frustrated, depressed, whatever language we use. So we know that the context we were given was faulty, and we need a new context.
Mm-hmm.
And so the soul knows this, and the human spirit knows this. And so the symbiosis between the soul and the spirit is to move you in the direction of contextual understanding of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, seeing yourself in the world and in a context that's healthy.
Yeah.
And this is
really
what mental health, this is what mental health would be. Mental health would be that I have found the context of which I can be, and mental illness would be I don't fit anywhere. There's no context for me to fit.
Right.
So it's just a matter. It's just a matter of what degree do I feel like a misfit? The more like a misfit I feel, the more mental illness I probably have. You see, and so that's the key. And when I say misfit, I don't mean in the culture. I mean inside your own sense of self.
Mm.
Because we're not. It isn't about just trying to fit in the external. It's being comfortable in your own skin. And then once you achieve that, then you fit everywhere. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, right. Because I was going to say, well, gee, I have felt like a misfit a lot as far as fitting in into what has sometimes felt to me like a dysfunctional society, but I'm very comfortable in my own being. So I don't feel like a misfit in that. So,
Well, spiritual people in kind of an existential sense, and when I say spiritual people, I mean people that are trying to seek a healthier context to be in the world. They
mm-hmm.
are by nature outsiders. In other words, they feel like they're outsiders because they are insiders. And people that are inside themselves with this relationship to the soul are going to be outsiders, you see. And that's the way that works.
It's just a matter of clarification.
It's just a matter as to what degree. And of course, you're moving, if you're doing this work correctly, you're going in and then you're coming out and going in and coming out. You go back and forth between the inside-outside dimension. And build a bridge between those two dimensions, and that really is that you can't be a total 100% insider, and you can't be a total 100% outsider. You're a little bit of both. We all are. So you have to build a bridge between those two dimensions of inside and outside, and that's it. That's the benefit of that bridge. It becomes a conduit.
To walk between the two worlds. Yeah, I know we had a conversation about that, and it was really, really helpful, the importance of that bridge.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's everything. Well, you know what? I'm going to say it differently to you tonight, Irma. If the umbilical cord is cut, that which we all undergo, and we feel detached from the Creator, then the bridge between the inside and outside world is a brand new umbilical cord.
Yes.
That's what it ends up becoming. It becomes so even deeper than a bridge. It becomes an umbilical cord. And you know where the life force is coming from. It isn't coming from the outside world where the umbilical cord is hanging in open space. It's from the umbilical cord that is connected internally to your own heart's and soul's intent. So we're really trying to reconnect or reattach an umbilical cord to move in between the inside outside world.
Yeah, I love that. I love that image. That's so great. Oh my goodness, I'm gonna keep that one. So the last.
Well,
so
we plug it. And so watch this. I'm gonna stay with that image. So you take the umbilical cord and you plug it into Catholicism. You plug it into organized religion. You plug it into Buddhism. You plug it into whatever you plug it in. The point is, we're looking to plug that cord that's flapping in the wind, we're looking for some place to plug it in, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't understand that what we're supposed to do is plug it back into ourselves, because that's we're not going to find any place to plug it in the outside world.
Oh, that's so true. And sometimes I've thought, you know, as far as spirituality and wholeness and how much codependency there is because of what you were just describing, trying to find something to plug into.
And so guess where it connects internally. And so if you've got an umbilical cord that's attached to something on the inside of you, and you've got a loose end that's flapping in the wind, what is that umbilical cord really seeking? What should it be attached to internally, do you imagine? Since you can't find any place to plug it in out here, or you can find a place, you can find religion, you can find different to plug it, and you're going to come up short because it isn't going to be the place it's supposed to be plugged in, where do you think it will be plugged in internally? You're going to love this.
Well, I would think the soul.
No.
The heart.
It would be the inner child. You have to reconnect it to the infant that is you.
Oh wow! See, that just gave me goosebumps because that's so true.
Yeah. You have to reconnect it to the infant that is you, and that really is what a born again experience would be.
Well, that's like a full circle moment right there.
Yeah, and that really is what that inner child. I said the inner child never gets any older than a teenager. Well, the inner child needs nourishment. It needs self worth and self esteem. It needs self love. And you're out here with your umbilical cord flapping in the wind. You need to reconnect it to the child that needs all of that. You see, and that's the child that is you. And so that's your adulthood to soulhood. You're not going to reach the adulthood until you raise the child that is in you. And that is literally what happens. So parenting yourself, one of the first parenting acts that you can make is to reconnect the cord to the infant that is you.
Oh, wow.
And then raise that, and then bring that child into the world in a different way, you see. It's almost like become the mother and father you never had.
Yeah.
Become the parent you wished you had. Become the mother and father you wished you had. This is all of us, you see. At some level, we have to do that. If you're an orphan, you get that. And I'm an orphan, so.
Yeah.
But that's why I love the inner child concept, because it certainly is ego, yes. But you're connecting the cord to a brand new ego. This new infant is a brand new ego. The potential of a brand new awakening ego, and it's an ego that's not formed yet, and it's an ego that has a parent that has its entire life experience now that it didn't have before when it was a child, this parent. And so now that this parent is grown and wise and mature and has evolved, it's more equipped now than ever before to raise a different kind of child. And the child it needs to raise now is the one that's in you. Yeah, totally different
thing. Oh, wow.
And this is what,
yeah.
Well, when you think about that, for those of us that are real parents, that's what it kind of says. You know, now you can cut the cord on your grown children and reconnect it to the source, which is the inner child that is within you. Now it's time to raise Ernie. It's time to raise Irma, you see, and bring them into the world with a whole different, with the benefit of wisdom and the benefit of maturity and depth that you did not have before. So you can see how profound of an image that is. Yeah.
Very, very profound. So I'd kind of like to close with the last question of the seeker. So if I understand this correctly, we don't have to push to live in the present. We need only to allow. In fact, if we are resisting the pull of our nature, we are resisting the pull of our nature out of fear. And the last paragraph I thought just was so profound. The divine answers, this is true. It is not necessarily that you have to do something to arrive. Instead, it is more that you need to, what you need to stop doing. You are fighting your own arrival, fighting what is driving you, ego, and denying what is pulling, soul, blocks discovery of the spiritual self. The soul knows the human condition comes with an unavoidable wound. In other words, you do not get to choose if you will suffer. You only get to choose how. Most people fixate on the why and never capture the soul's intent. In fact, suffering is the labor of getting here.
Yep.
I love that. It's just wise words.
And it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Going back to that, to what I said a minute ago, it makes perfect sense that if you're reattaching that umbilical cord, taking it out from trying to plug it into something in the outside world and plug it back into the inner child that is you, then you can then your life force begins to feed that child, you see.
Mm-hmm.
How you nourish yourself, how you care for yourself begins to nourish that infant. And that infant, and I've actually used that in treatment before, that I've said to people, what if I told you that you're leaving this experience right now with me pregnant, and that you've already been conceived, you've already gestated, you've already been pregnant. All that's left is the delivery. And so where we are in our spiritual awakening is that process. And see, when I was working with severe trauma, these people were having what I would call a forced birth. They were forced to birth their child before they were ready to birth their child, because they were so awakened by their trauma that they now had to take responsibility for themselves in a way they had never imagined that they would have to before. And so it's a birthing experience to be awakened and to be awakened so abruptly. And so that's it. I mean, that's the process. And so what we said at the beginning of the show about that your capacity to parent yourself trickles down to your children. Well, now change that and say that the capacity which you parent yourself determines if you're going to arrive or not. Because to not arrive would be to have a stillborn birth. And this is a lot. And so what I end up saying about that is, and I've seen people in this stage, they've extended their labor. In other words, they're ready to be here, they're ready to get here, but because of fear, because of distortions of whatever, they're not allowing the birth to happen. And in doing so, they are walking around with a stillborn baby, you see, which is them.
Yeah.
And you can see the grief. You can see the grief there, and you can see the frustration, the anger there. So, yeah, it's a big emotional realization.
Right. And the soul's intent is arrival is a choice. And so we're going to continue. We're going to continue next week with chapter 2. And thank you so much, Ernie. I think this show has been wonderful as usual. And thank you for sharing your wisdom with our listeners. And I look forward to next week. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Irma. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Good night, Ernie.
Night, Irma.